Hi, and welcome to Common Denominator, straight up conversations with me, Moshe Popak. Each week we take a deep dive into a current event that's impacting your life. And in the process, we hear from innovators and thought leaders to both educate and inspire you. This week's guest is CBS News meteorologist and climate specialist, Jeff Berardelli. He'll break down climate change and global warming, tell us how concerned we should be and what we can do as a country and as individuals before it's too late. That and more next.
This is Common Denominator, straight up conversations with Moshe Popak. Now, here's Moshe.
Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So, just as a layperson, we're seeing different events of extreme weather. How serious do you feel climate change is an issue facing us today?
Well, you know, contrary to, I think, what a lot of people think of when they think of climate change, because you think of extreme weather, big fires, that's a big deal, right? Big hurricanes where you live, that's a big deal. Drought in the West and drought in many parts of the world, that's a big deal. I think about it a little bit more systemically. And what I worry about most is international conflict due to climate change because of, you know, a big drought that breaks out in a place that has a lot of agriculture. People no longer have places to grow food. They no longer have livelihoods. They move to different parts of their country, either within or across borders. And that displacement, that migration, helps to fuel more international conflict. So I think about it kind of in the bigger picture. I do worry about bigger hurricanes. Like, for instance, the flood that just hit New York City and, you know, and New Jersey. Because it's such a populated area, I've heard estimates of damage up to $50 billion, you know, and so that's more than most hurricanes cost. So the problem, obviously, is if you have, instead of five of those, like you might have had back in the 1980s, you have 20 a year. Where does that money come from? You know, and what does that do to insurance rates? What does that do to mortgages? So on and so forth. So thinking about it more systemically, that's my concern. And I do think it's a big deal.
It's interesting because I have come from New York and I have a lot of family there. And that is a real concern. You know, people are talking about to me, oh, you're living in Miami. Shouldn't you be concerned about hurricanes? And right. And then here we have, you know, they got affected. Basements were flooded. Cars were flooded. Family members, you know, out of their homes, dealing mm-hmm. with cleanup. So, but how do you see, just from a general perspective, that climate change? Do you think that actually caused this Ida to come into New York? And how do
it's a good question.
How do you link that?
It's a good question. No, climate change didn't cause Ida to come to New York, and it didn't cause Ida to begin with, but it made it stronger. And it made it more moist. There was more moisture with it. That's how climate change works. So climate change is these small increases in degrees, just a couple of degrees, have an exponential impact. And that's specific, especially to fires in the West. There is an exponential relationship between increases in temperature and aridity, which is dryness, and the amount of acres burned. And it's tremendous. So we're seeing that play out in the West, right? Last year was by far the biggest fire season in California history. This year, the Dixie Fire is about 900,000 acres. It burns another 100,000 acres. It becomes the largest fire ever in California history. What was the largest fire in California history? It was last year. Wow. So you can clearly see, we've done the science on it, that as you increase temperatures, your fire acreage burned and the intensity and size of these fires doesn't increase linearly. It goes like that. And we're seeing that happen. And you could see that with your own eyes, right? You see what's happening across the West. Now, it's not exactly the same with hurricanes and with floods. But for every 1 degree increase in ocean temperature, we've already seen 1 degree Celsius or 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the Atlantic Ocean. You see about an increase in intensity of hurricanes by around 20 miles an hour. 20 miles an hour stronger than it would have otherwise been. I'll just say one more thing, and then I know you have questions. So the reason why this matters is, and I'll ask you a question. Take a hurricane that has winds of 75 miles an hour and compare it to a hurricane with winds of 150 miles an hour. So it's doubly as strong in terms of its winds, right?
Sure.
How much more damage do you think it does? I'm just asking you. There's a right answer, but I'm just.
No, guessing. Well, I'm just thinking, 75 to 150, I mean, it's, you can't even compare when we look at the damage, it's exponential. So I don't even know. Right. Maybe it could be 100x. It could be whatever
it's
amount.
250x.
250x. Okay.
250. And the reason is, yeah, right, if you have a 75-mile-an-hour wind and you have a house, it'll rip a couple shingles off your roof, but your roof will remain intact, right? You have 150-mile-an-hour wind, your roof's gone, your structure's gone. Now, all of a sudden, it's instead of $500 or $1,000 worth of damage, it's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in damage. So that's why climate change matters, because just small incremental changes in warmth create, you know, decent increases in intensity of storms and then dramatic increases in economic damage.
And I assume you don't feel that we have the infrastructure. Let's just take the U.S. In the U.S., do you feel that we have the infrastructure in place to deal with these different weather events?
Certainly not. And you know this firsthand because you live in South Florida. So Hurricane Andrew came into Homestead and Coral Gables and it completely annihilated that area. That's because houses weren't built at the time to sustain Category 3 winds. Florida has the most stringent hurricane, you know, infrastructure law in place. Houses now need to be built to withstand Category 3 force winds. Climate change is making Cat 3s Cat 4s and Cat 4s Cat 5s. It's happening all the time now. We see a lot bigger and stronger hurricanes. So Florida is well set up, but not every state has the same laws as Florida does. So even Florida would have a hard time with the biggest of hurricanes. Other places really have a hard time.
And it's interesting because we also had Sandy in New York a few years ago. And I'm thinking, wow, now we got hit twice. I'm thinking, because I know from the real estate perspective, that's my main business, that our premium probably doubled in the past 2 years. And I know in New York, it didn't really jump as much. It jumped some, but it's interesting to see, you know, New Yorkers, like I said before, they're just, oh, you know, everything's fine. But we're seeing that real time now that they're actually getting affected.
Absolutely. And climate change does make flooding worse. In fact, there's an exact relationship. For every 2 degrees Fahrenheit, we see 8% more water vapor in the atmosphere. Doesn't sound like much, but it's just 8% in that one place. But what storms do, and you've seen hurricanes, you know them because you live in South Florida, they have tentacles, right? You can't see my arms, but the tentacles go out, sucking moisture in. So it's 8%, but it's compounded because a hurricane's a really effective engine at pulling all that moisture together and compounding it. So Hurricane Harvey in Texas had about 20 to 40% more rain than it would have otherwise had. So getting back to your example of New York City, it's a certain, you know, amount of sea level rise and storm surge that Battery Park City in the southern part of Manhattan can take, right? Maybe that's 8 feet. Let's say climate change, because of sea level rise and because of the intensity of the storm, made that storm surge another 1.5, 2 feet larger. If it was going to be 8 feet of storm surge, it wouldn't have breached the wall. But now it's 9.5 or 10 feet of storm surge, and 2 feet of water is now inundating the buildings in southern Manhattan. So your damage goes from minuscule to hundreds of millions of dollars or more. And you get the point that I'm making. So yep. If your infrastructure is built for a storm of the 1950s, it really needs to be updated to a storm of the 2020.
Because I see,
or really the future.
They keep mentioning in the news about kind of the Arctic melting. I guess that affects the sea level. Is that as more water, you know, melts away, it builds up sea level. And is that kind of the idea, or?
Right. So there's Greenland and Antarctica. The Arctic ice is floating already. It's kind of like ice cubes on in a glass of water. So even though the ice is not melted yet, once it melts, it's still the same level of water. So it doesn't change anything. But in the Arctic, like you mentioned, we also have Greenland. And in Antarctica, we have ice on land as well. In both places, the ice is on land. So that melts and that goes into the water. It causes sea level rise. But I will say one thing. I think there's a misperception because we don't know exactly how much sea level is going to rise and we don't know how fast it's going to happen. There are estimates. And oftentimes you hear we're going to see 2 or 3 feet of sea level rise in 10 years or 20 years. It's not likely. What's more likely is maybe at most more likely. And again, I'm not a sea level rise expert, but I study this, you know, generally climate change. maybe we'll see another foot by 2050. So that's 30 years. That's a lot, but you're a builder. You're in real estate. So you understand this. More likely it would be something like 3 feet or so by 2100. Now, there are some caveats to that. And the caveats are if there's a destabilization in Antarctica or Greenland where a big part of the ice sheet falls into the water, that's not something we can predict. What we can say is if that were to happen, it would be catastrophic, right? So if there's a tipping point there, and there are tipping points, we don't know exactly when we're going to hit them. That's where the uncertainty comes in. So sometimes you hear of in South Florida, we could have 6 feet or 8 feet of sea level rise by 2100. It is possible, but it would require some type of destabilization of Antarctica or Greenland that we just cannot predict. It's a matter of, do you want to build for worst case or, you know, worst case type scenarios, or do you want to build for the most likely case scenarios?
And it was interesting because I saw a few weeks ago, the UN governing body on the environment came out that climate change is like the number one, it's like red zone, number one issue facing humans today. But what I did see is that of the top 10 countries that are responsible for the carbon emissions, only I think two or three are doing their part. I know India's and China are tremendously responsible for carbon emissions. So even if, let's say, the U.S., we do our part. I know the president mentioned about reducing carbon emissions by 50% by 2030. Let's say we do these things. Do you feel globally, as a human race, we're really going to make a material impact on climate change?
First of all, yes, I do think it would help because when we make moves, the world will in fact follow, but it's more for economic reasons. So I would just say, and I think about this a lot, oftentimes when I think about leading on green initiatives like renewable energy, I think about just outperforming and beating China because it is the next frontier, right? It's the move from horse and buggy to cars. It's the move from, you know, whatever we had before technology to technology in the 1990s. This renewable energy is essentially that next thing. And, you know, as far as being a country that leads and wants to continue being an economic power and hopefully be superpower, which is going to be difficult competing with a country like China, which is a dictatorship and they have more people than we do. I just think about it that way. I want the United States to lead. And I know that if we do and we innovate like we normally do, all those things will spread across the world. Right now, China is investing about twice the amount of money, if not more, than we invest in renewables. I'd prefer as an American to lead on that. Yeah. I don't want to fall behind in the next frontier. It's like if we had fallen behind in technology, Google, Apple, Facebook, so on and so forth.
So you think renewables would be renewable energy would be the number one step, material step in your mind to do our part in the U.S. to deal with climate change?
So in this reconciliation package, which may or may not pass, there's something called a clean electricity standard. So it's interesting because, you know, you can put restrictions on power plants, what kinds of power they use, and regulation. But actually, it turns out that I think in this case, it's mostly a carrot, not a stick approach. And what I mean by that is, in the reconciliation package, they're offering incentives and rewards for power generators to use renewable energy rather than using oil and gas, so that it's not necessarily a regulation, it's a reward if you do good. So that can accomplish decarbonizing our economy by like 70%. Just the renewable energy or clean energy standard can decarbonize our economy by something like 70%. That just that one thing.
But I'm seeing I'm seeing the people, well, obviously in the oil and gas industry, their claim is that now we're having to be dependent, at least in the short term, on foreign imports of oil and gas. I don't know about that argument. Yeah.
During the transition, that's true. Right. You know, the United States is the largest supplier now of natural gas in the world. We're a net exporter now. That happened under Barack Obama, you know. So, and actually, the thought had always been that gas was cleaner than coal. There are some scientists and there's some literature that says it's not, and I'll tell you why. Because although gas doesn't emit as much carbon into the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, the leakage from methane in the pipes and in the line leading up to when you use it is 2-5%, somewhere in that range, depending upon how efficient it is. So right now, at least, and that's one thing we need to do. And you know, it's interesting because oil and gas companies are losing a lot of methane to the atmosphere. So they're losing a lot of their profit. That's something they haven't tackled because they've been making money hand over fist and it wasn't necessary, but they are actually being more efficient would help their bottom line. And it would quickly reel in methane, which is, by the way, 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas. So it turns out natural gas should be cleaner than coal, but it's not because of the leakage. So once we take care of the leakage, that helps, you know, it helps to be a bridge fuel. Scientists hate the term bridge fuel because in many ways, renewable energy is cheaper now than most fossil fuels, not just to use, but also to construct. To run some fossil fuel power plants that are older right now is more costly than to build and operate renewable energy like wind and solar at this point.
And what can we do just from an individual, you and I, that we can make, it's person by person, to make a difference on climate change in our daily lives?
The most important thing is, number one, vote for people who you know, share those either environmental or economic ideals. That's the number one. And then number two is to patronize companies that are also good to the environment, because it's the power of the purse that is most important. You changing your light bulb is not going to matter. You buying a Tesla matters, or some other renewable or some other electric car, or putting solar panels in your house matters, because your neighbors see it. And theoretically, they're like, oh, Moshe just put solar panels on his house. I want to get solar panels. So it spreads. The point is, thinking about it, how can I make a big impact? Instead of switching your power over to solar power, you do that. But you also figure out a way to, if you really want to make a big impact, to call your local power company or to call your local congressperson, whatever. The point is, making systemic, system-wide impacts, community-wide impacts is the most important thing.
I just wanted to ask you this, just a little off topic, but being at CBS, a meteorologist, what's the coolest part of your job?
I get to be instrumental in educating people on this, on climate change.
Right.
The whole reason I moved to New York, so you might not know this about me, I was working in Palm Beach as a chief meteorologist there. I left a very lucrative contract and moved to New York with no job. My wife had no job either. To go to Columbia to get my master's degree in climate change so that I could hopefully work my way into a network and start educating people on climate change on a national level. So this for me was a mission that I undertook because I thought this is a big existential problem that humans will face, especially our children and our grandchildren. And it's not, the media isn't even talking about it. So for me, it is that. It's the ability to reach people and educate them on things that they're not following like I do every day, right? I see it on my weather maps. I'm like, holy cow, look at what's happening on my weather maps. But people are not looking at my weather maps like I do. So they don't know the crazy changes that are happening.
Well, I want to really thank you, Jeff, for enlightening us on this subject. How could people follow you on social media?
At WeatherProf on Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter, not so active on Facebook, or I think I have a TikTok account, but I have never used it. So.
How can people see you on TV?
Oh, I work for CBS This Morning, and so on CBS News, and also CBSN, which is our 24-hour digital channel.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff. Really informative and really appreciated. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for giving me the chance to speak to your listeners.
Thanks for listening to the Common Denominator podcast. Join us next week for another inspiring, impactful, and empowering conversation. To learn more about Moshe, head to moshepopak.com. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it. And we'd be grateful if you could rate, review, and subscribe to the show.